welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I hope you're very well. My guest this week is magazine editor and author Farah Storr, who joins me to talk about her new book, The Discomfort Zone. I've known Farah for quite a few years now on the magazine circuit. I may or may not have stalked her when I heard she was going to be the launch editor of Women's Health when it came to the UK. By stalking, I mean polite emails. Nothing to worry about. But I know she's a formidable force in publishing, and when Women's Health did launch in 2012 with a tiny team of a couple of people, it had huge expectations, but it achieved those expectations. It met them all, going on to become one of the most successful magazine launches ever, in spite of that tiny team. Or, if you read The Discomfort Zone, because of it. In this conversation, we talk about the fact that being outside of your comfort zone is where the magic happens, and yet we find ourselves in a culture where we're encouraged not to feel that discomfort. It's something, Farah says, that's killing creativity, deadening ambition, and means a whole generation are stifled by fear. I remember a personal trainer telling me years ago that if there isn't a part of your workout that hurts, that you think that you can't do, and you just quit, then you're never going to make progress. And it's a similar thing. You have to push through that discomfort to get to the other side. And so I definitely, when I was reading the book, I thought, yep, I get this. This is so true. This is so true. It's not just in the gym. It's in all aspects of life. And it resonated with me as someone who I definitely look back and think I've let opportunities pass me by because I was either too scared of what other people thought or too scared of failure. I'm not sure what I was scared of, but I was definitely ruled and governed by fear. And so I stepped back into my comfort zone rather than stepping into my discomfort zone, which now I've read this book, I realise is one of the best things that you can do. This is Farah's first book. And in the bumper episode that this is, she tells me how she set about writing it while still editing Cosmopolitan and giving TED Talks and the like, and the life experiences that meant that this was her book to write. And there's so much more in this show, there really is. Now, there are a few punchy topics in this episode, so it's only right I give a trigger warning, as some of the discomfort zones might be upsetting for some listeners. But making her debut, here she is, Farah Storr, talking about all manner of things, including her new book, The Discomfort Zone. Here she is on The Emma Gunn Show. Well, I'm very excited. Farah Storr is with me, editor, author, all round. Well, the TED Talk, I mean.
Oh, there's two now, you know. Yeah, the first one wasn't very good, so I did another one.
The first one wasn't very good. Are you joking?
I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for with the first one, but it's interesting. But the second one, I hope, interestingly, someone did say to me worryingly, the first one's better than the second one. And so because there were 2 years between them, it's not a good sign, is it, if one's got worse than the first one? But yeah.
Do you think maybe you're a little bit too hard on yourself?
Yes, I've always been, and actually, I actually think that's really important sometimes, to be quite tough on yourself. I've always believed when people go, oh, you're just too hard on yourself. I always go, well, actually, that's kind of what makes me strive. I think that's where a lot of my drive comes from.
Totally. I think it's the annoying piece of, not even advice, the annoying observation that a lot of my friends make to me is, you're just being a bit too hard on yourself. And then I think, and then I do think, like you, and a bit like the book that we're going to discuss, amongst many other things, is if I didn't have that, would I have started a podcast? Would I have gone into journalism?
Yeah, so you need an internal motivation or that little voice. And for me, that if being hard on yourself makes you move forward, it gives you the momentum, then I don't have a major issue with it. So yes, in answer to your question, I am very hard on myself.
But it's a good thing. So we've got lots to discuss today, but we're going to leap in with your book, your new book, The Discomfort Zone.
Yes, out end of September.
Out, and will be available when this podcast is live.
Yes, can pre-order it, yep.
And I found this very interesting because for me, for me personally, as somebody who definitely lives on adrenaline and cortisol, and quite proudly so, even though I know it's not necessarily that good for me, it gives me permission to flip that feeling into a positive rather than letting it suck me into a negative hole of, why can't I do something? And so my question was, after you explain better than I just have what the book is about, why is this the book that you wrote?
I think it's the book that I wrote. I mean, first of all, I didn't actually want to write a book. So somebody suggested when I was talking about my career, and I was saying it's interesting because the two major successes I would say I've had in my career are one, which is launching Women's Health, and one, which was taking over and revamping Cosmo. And it's probably no coincidence, actually, both of those were very, very difficult experiences for me. So Women's Health, it was a team of there were two other people, so there was three of us. There was very little budget. My salary was very small. The hours were very long. We had to sell 100,000 copies from issue one, or we wouldn't launch. So huge amount of pressure, huge amount of constraint. And then Cosmo was different again because it was a huge, big heritage brand. I had to get it back to being the best-selling young women's magazine, hadn't been for 16 years. And unfortunately, along the way, 80%, I think we worked it out the other day, of the team resigned. So interestingly, I found myself kind of back in the same place as Women's Health with a very small team that I had to lead and convince them actually that I was the right leader to make a success of this project. So when I look back on my career, the things which have been most successful are actually the things where I was really put through the ringer in a way. They were very, very difficult. But actually, I think Women's Health, certainly, because of a lot of the constraints, time constraint, money constraints, we were able to be very creative in ways that I don't think we would have been. Had I had big budgets and had lots of times, I would have second-guessed things. I would have put things out for committee, and we always know what happens when you do things by committee is you end up with a very bland, generic idea. You end up, you know, Women's Health, I ended up going with my guts very much, and actually I think a lot of the time, as much as we say, you know, guts are just these kind of bunch of woo-woo feelings, actually your gut is pattern recognition. A lot of the time it knows. So in answer to your question, I think my greatest successes in my career and personal life as well, actually, have been when I've definitely stepped out of my comfort zone and into the discomfort zone. And I think particularly in the culture at the moment, you know, you hear it like universities having these things called safe spaces where, you know, if you feel challenged or you feel uncomfortable.
Triggered.
Yeah, or triggered, exactly.
Yeah.
Or microaggressions. I think it's crazy. I think actually, you know, life is pressure, life is tough, but actually you are tougher and you have the capacity to be really tough if only you knew how to channel that toughness. And so this book is, you know, if you are feeling that the world is tough and you don't know what to do about it, well, like, this is kind of your handbook. And actually what you'll find and what I found researching the book was the human body and mind, it is made to carry a load. It's made to be a little bit under pressure. And you can achieve incredible things by that. But you've got to make the first step, which is stepping into the discomfort zone.
And how did you set about writing it? Because in this book, you talk to some incredible people, and the anecdotes and the commentary from some of these people. I mean, when you talk about the guy whose name I've now forgotten, but the guy who did America's Most Wanted.
Oh, yes, John Walsh.
I found that paragraph really punched me in the gut.
Right.
The story about how he started that.
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, he is the kind of grey-haired man behind Most Wanted. But actually, and you think he, and for many years I thought he was just a, you know, a very charismatic TV presenter. But of course, when I did some research for a story on him years ago, actually he lost his, I mean, his son was abducted from a department store and was found. I mean, he was beheaded. I mean, he was murdered in the most grotesque way. And so out of that absolutely terrible, terrible, like ghastly trauma, came something kind of incredible. Of course, he would never have wanted to lose his son, but actually he felt motivated to do something very positive. So America's Most Wanted, it was launched by John Walsh, as were those milk cartons. I don't know if they still do them anymore in America, where they have the kids who vanished, they have them on the back of milk cartons. He came up with that as well. I mean, you know, I think that whole chapter is about how you can turn trauma into triumph. Of course, you hope the trauma doesn't happen in the first place, but actually not everybody is decimated by trauma. You know, we know about post-traumatic stress, but actually some people grow. And the truth is you can have both. But that chapter is very much about, well, if something terrible has happened to you, And hopefully nothing is as terrible as what happened to John Walsh and his family. But how do you grow from that experience? And in the book, I interviewed the woman that was in the 7/7 bombings.
I found that I've thought about nothing else since I read that.
Right. And you know, terrible, terrible experience. But she made sense of the experience. Mm. And actually now, you know, she's OBE. She runs this incredibly influential charity where she is engaging disenfranchised Muslim youths. She's creating a greater good for the world, which would never have happened. I remember she said to me, and I'm paraphrasing now, but she was like, if that hadn't have happened to me, if I hadn't have been on that carriage when the bomb went off, I think she was between King's Cross and Russell Square. She's like, my life was very much about shoes and bags, and it was a very shallow existence because of the trauma I experienced. She said, I have grown in ways. You know, she speaks to thousands of people across the world. Mm. So the book, that chapter in particular, is about the strength that actually you can have through something terrible happening to you.
And I found all of the anecdotes, the firefighter, everything. And I feel as though I kept coming back to trusting your gut. There's something, there is like a rudder that sometimes we forget to use.
Right.
And we get caught up in handbags and shoes and material things.
Yes.
And actually, it can take many things to bring you back to your truth, as it were.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, you have to know, I guess you have to be able to hone your gut so that your gut is giving you the right information. But yes, I mean, I think ultimately most people know. I mean, it's even like when you are in your discomfort zone, somebody was saying to me, well, how do you know? And I was like, well, you know, it's like when you're doing something scary, your body, it's like, I think I give an example in the book, it's like when you've got a bank statement and you've got the letter, you've got the piece of paper. I used to do this years ago. Actually, I still do, to be completely honest. And you don't know why. It's irrational. You're like, why do I feel really nervous?
Yeah.
But it's because contained in that envelope is how you spend your money, how you live your life. So your body, you just have to listen to your body. It tells you. And I suppose one of the things that I'm really keen on telling people is, when you're in your discomfort zone or when you're doing something difficult, and when I say difficult, I mean, you know, in inverted commas, challenging, it's a really good thing. And so the important thing to remember is that, because you only have a couple of seconds in which you interpret the sweating palms and the beating heart as fear, or you interpret it as a challenge state, I think scientists call it, which is you interpret it as excitement. And you have to make that switch very quickly, because otherwise you go into panic mode and you just freeze. And so again, it was very important to me in the book that actually you tell people your body knows the answer, but are you listening to it in the right way?
Mm-hmm. And you've experienced the paralysis.
Yeah, like lots of times. And actually throughout my career, you know, I've, you know, God, when I used to first do public speaking, which I do a lot of now, I mean, it was awful. You know, I used to think, oh, my God. And you know what the paralysis is like. You can be stood there and the words don't come. Well, actually, the thoughts don't come. And now it's a really subtle thing. You know, now when I give talks, and even if this is just talks, you know, I still get nervous when I give talks in front of, say, a room full of, like, my colleagues. But I try and interpret the kind of, you know, the sweating palms, the beating heart. It's exciting, actually. And it stops me from going into that, into paralysis mode. And it's very important you do it very quickly. You know, the stories you tell yourselves are really powerful, but you've got to be quick.
Yes, which is why I think that you have created your own brand of nano meditation.
Nano meditation. Sounds like nano meditation. I would fancy some of that, actually.
That's just a nap.
Yes, that is. I have lots of those.
Nano naps for life. No, but this is the joke I made to Farah beforehand, was, oh, I've got a business idea, and it's nano meditation.
And I told you I've got no money, so don't try and pitch me anything that requires lots of money.
For the overstretched, anxious person, it's just a nanosecond of clarity to get clarity.
I think you're onto something there. Yeah.
Great, I'll run with it. Also, so this moment, I think it's very interesting. I used to do a lot of live TV and a bit like public speaking. And you had an experience where you were nervous. You were thrown into this situation where there were a lot more people in the room than you were expecting.
Oh, there were like 18,000 more people than I thought. Yeah.
And I can imagine the mechanics of your body were working. So you were walking into the room and you walked up the stairs onto the stage. But maybe there was white noise in your head. And then all of a sudden, in that nano-meditative moment, you did something that relaxed the entire situation for everyone involved.
Yes, because, I mean, I mean, God, it was terrible, really. I mean, I was supposed to be interviewing, I think he was a tech founder on stage at a conference, and it really is my fault because I hadn't really looked it up, but I presume we were on like a smallish stage. Mm. And at that point, I don't think I'd spoken to, you know, them more than maybe like 100 people maximum before. And so I'd agreed to do this conference. And anyway, I turned up. And it was in the biggest arena in Europe. It's one of the biggest arenas in Europe, certainly in that country. And it was the main stage, and it was 20,000 people, and it was absolutely huge. And the terrible thing about it was the organizer, who was this, you know, very charismatic, super confident young guy. And this was obviously his thing. He obviously wanted to be like a rock star. And I remember he came rushing off the stage, and you know, tech guys. Usually very nice guys, but they're not extroverts. Mm. So my job was to make him feel at ease. So this young kind of cultish guy comes running off and he goes, guys, it's a massive crowd. What we need is we need to get some pictures of you. So you need to hold the crowd for 15 seconds while we get these pictures. And I just like, and I could see there was a massive clock and you could see the clock ticking down to when we were about to be on. So I was like,
it's a long time.
15 seconds to hold 20,000 people. And it was the end of the day. It was just awful. And this kind of tech guy looked at me and I looked at him and I was like, oh my God. I mean, because I was basically in charge there. And I remember I walked on the stage and it could have been disastrous. Like I could have just froze, but I didn't. And I remember thinking, I need to distract them. And so I remember asking everyone, it's miraculous that they did this. If you ask people questions, it's very clever because they stop thinking about you and start thinking about themselves. So it does distract them. And I remember saying to everyone, so you've all got phones because it's a tech conference. And I want to take a giant selfie. So can you all turn your lights on your phones? And as if by magic, they did it. So I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. And then I think the tech guy then kind of he kind of gathered momentum and he was like, right, can you all turn? And we took this amazing selfie with like these 20,000 kind of twinkling lights. And we got the picture. I mean, he got his 15 seconds, they got their picture, we got our mass selfie. And I had control of the crowd. And after that, it was very easy. But the reason I think that my body knew what to do, and this comes back to gut, is that actually, you know, gut instinct is, you think it's just in your gut. It's not actually, it's all over your body. Mm. It's just that you kind of feel it in your gut. But gut instinct is pattern recognition. So if you've done something enough, and that's why when I talked about you have to hone your gut, you have to keep on putting yourselves in similar-ish situations for your gut to be really... for your gut to be on fire, I suppose. And so because I had done lots of little bits of public speaking before, I knew that asking a question, one of my real discomfort things is when I walk on a stage and you have to get everyone's attention. Mm. I found that very difficult because there's nothing worse than, you know, if you crack a joke and no one laughs. And one of the things that I knew was asking questions of people usually creates silence quite quickly. And so because of that, my body knew, my gut knew that you need to ask a question here. Mm-hmm. So guts is it's not necessarily doing the same thing over and over again, but it's doing lots of experiences which are similar through which your gut can extrapolate information, which can then kind of save you if you end up like an idiot like I was without checking, you know, where you are in the agenda, you know, arena.
You known?
I don't know if I'd have done it. Yeah, I don't know if I'd have done it, to be completely honest. I mean, now, of course, I always say yes to things and I don't... I say yes immediately to lots of things and I do that because actually, for me personally, if I say, can I think about it, usually I'll say no. Mm. And so actually I say yes and then I figure it out. I just go, you will always find a way to make something work. So actually, it's probably not true. If I had been told it was in this huge arena with 20,000 people, I would have said yes. And then I would have... afterwards, not panicked, I would have figured out a plan because, you know, all you ever want in life, all anyone wants, I think, and we don't have this, of course, but you want the illusion of control, that you're in control of your life. And I think by saying yes, by then formulating a plan of how am I going to get through this talk of 20,000 people, if I have a plan, if you have a plan of things, it makes it 80% easier.
Mm. It reminds me a little bit, I spoke to Jo Fairley recently, and she writes features all the time. And I was saying to her that it doesn't matter who commissions me, what the feature is, I will always have that same nerves. that I used to get on, like, when I used to do work experience, of having the blank piece, of having the carrot, the cursor, I still call it the carrot, because, you know, 1980s, flashing. And I still get, like, a surge of adrenaline, cortisol, whatever it is, but it's that panic thing. And she thought it was quite interesting, and she said, well, when someone says to me, how long does it take you to write a feature, I tell them 2 hours and 30 years.
Yes, is right. She's absolutely right. Yeah. But wouldn't you say that's a good thing? I would love to know that my writers feel that surge of adrenaline before they put pen to paper, or, you know, fingertip to, what do we do now? Everyone types. No one uses pen and paper anymore.
But it
motivates you, because, you know, to do your best. I mean, I think, if you felt completely comfortable, I mean, we all know what it's like, isn't it? If you are just dashing, you can tell when people have dashed off a feature. Mm-hmm. When it lands on my desk, I can tell when something's lazy. I can tell when someone's just doing it to get the money. You can tell when someone's laboured over it. You can tell it from the first sentence. And that's probably what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the dream, because that's what pushes you, isn't it? And we all need push. And actually, adrenaline, of course, if it doesn't tip into full-on panic mode, adrenaline is that internal, you know, motivation. So I'm the same. I always feel every time I get something new to write, or a commission, or even doing this, you feel a little bit on edge, but actually get comfortable with that uncomfortable feeling, because that's what's going to do the work for you. It's going to get you through.
And I remember I've been doing QVC, so live on air, for about 3 years. And I was in a changing room before going on air. And before I would go on air, you'd get, like, in your dress and everything. And I'd have to have at least 3 panic wheeze.
Do you have to have special panic wheeze? Yes, I get those. Do you have to have special dresses for QVC?
Oh, no, it's just that I used to have, like, a QVC wardrobe.
Oh, right.
I used to have a bright blue dress and a bright red dress.
Based on any sort of...
Oh, the science of people like bold, bright colours.
Right, okay. Did you sell more when you had the red dress on?
I never looked into that, actually. But actually, now you say it, that would have been my first question to someone who posited that they wore a blue and a red. How interesting. Maybe, who knows? I might have to go through the old data. Anyway, I remember being in the dressing room, and I've been doing it for a long time. And somebody came in, and I said, oh, excuse me, I've just got to go and have a panic wee. And I obviously made light of it.
Did you tell them it was a panic wee?
Always. Okay, I have no filter.
Right.
I just always had to make sure I did
it before
I was mic'd up.
Well, it's good, because when you do that, don't you find it's a test of people? Because you can see... It's like, I always find, if the more open I am, it's a test of whether you're going to get on with that person. So if you start talking about panic wees and they're just shocked... You get a measure of someone with, or it's just because we're getting old and it's like those naughty elderly people who are just say rude things to wind people up, of course.
No, I agree with you. I'm very honest, and I find that it means it makes it very easy to bring people close to me, because they, like, get my humour. Or people think I'm a basic bitch and just don't want to spend any time with me.
Right. So you either get amazing honesty from them and they open up, or they hate you.
Exactly. Yeah. And do you know what?
Divisiveness is good, I think.
I think so. And I remember saying, and I said, I had to go for panic wink. When I came back, she said, are you nervous? And I said, oh, God, every single time. And I said, is that bad? And she said, no, the day that you're not nervous before you go on air is the day that you need to stop doing it.
Yeah, yeah. So QVC is just probably full of these people pumped with adrenaline in red dresses.
It is a hurry up and wait situation. It is. It's very, very tiring.
So do you have the people on before you, and you see how well they've done, and then you're carted on? Yeah. So is it very competitive as well?
Actually, I've made some of my really great friends as a grown-up in the green room at QVC, like other guest presenters.
But you don't get competitive with how much you sell?
Well, I certainly didn't, and the people that I'm friends with certainly didn't. There were people there who were competitive,
sure?
But they're not on my speed dial. Because I just think we're all selling completely different things.
It's interesting, but you see the numbers, don't you? Don't
yeah, you
see
do.
How much you're selling? So it's like, sell more, sell more.
But then if someone's having a bad sale, or someone's having a great sale, you say, you give, offer your condolences or congratulate accordingly. Like, everyone
I'm
has
quite
a bad
fascinated
day.
By QVC.
We can take that offline.
Sadly, never been asked to go on, but I've been fascinated
what would you sell?
By it. Oh, God.
Apart from the book.
Shame I couldn't sell my book, really. I don't know what
they
I'd
sell. They do sell books on QVC.
Do they? Mm-hmm. Oh, discomforts. Do you know what? I think if you're at home watching QVC, you're probably quite happy in your comfort zone, to be honest. You know, if you're watching it at 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, yeah, I don't think you need
maybe
my book
buy
in
it
your
for
life.
A friend.
Yeah, I think so.
Very interesting. Another thing that you mentioned was... well, what I would say is journaling, where you have always been somebody who writes a lot. But then the thing I was saying to you earlier about the conclusion that I've drawn between the book and some other thing. In fact, we'll go into that first and okay. we'll come back to that. So we'll talk about friendships.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to talk about this in terms of being sensitive. And I reading your book and reading it through my eyes, which is through the eyes of a very sensitive person, I saw quite a lot of symmetry between some of the stories you told and some of my experiences. Right. And especially in that TED talk, when you talk about your inner child who came to the rescue at just the right time. I was in tears, by the way, when I was watching that.
Aww.
I watched it several times, and I watched it again this morning before I came Aww. In here, and I really did well up.
Aww. Well, I think, yeah, because I think your inner child, it's very easy to become, you know, tethered away from them, isn't it? I think, and actually, I think the sometimes you have to be. I mean, I, you know, God, it was so long ago I did that talk, but when I say to people, you know, I'm really an introvert. People, I mean, they actually laugh in my face. They're like, I can't believe that. And I was like, yeah, but the world has required me to be something other mm-hmm. in order to get ahead. And you know, there's lots of arguments for, well, you know, the world should bend and should allow people to be themselves, which of course is my point, but that's going to take a very, you know, I'm mm-hmm. a pragmatist as well. And so, but I think it's very, it's very sad, isn't it, people that lose their, I think it's losing your way, isn't it? I think when you are a child, I think, and I was talking with my inner child in that TED talk. What I was like is like a 9 or 10 year old, where you're pretty much kind of roughly formed. Mm. And I think for a lot of my life, because I thought you had to go out into the working world and be somebody else in order to succeed. And Emma, the truth is, that worked. It did work. If I had stayed as this quiet, timid child, I don't think I would be where I am today. I mean, that is the hard truth. But I think maybe, you know, I think people get upset at that TED talk because I think people do lose their way, they forget who they are. But you can find it is the other thing. I mean, actually, I feel very, very close to my inner child now because my massive new passion in life is gardening. I'm obsessed with it. And actually, gardening with my dogs is pretty much what I used to just play in the garden with my dogs when I was a little girl. So actually, I have found a way of actually, I can't be that little girl at work. It's not appropriate. My team wouldn't want it from me, actually. I think they want a leader who, even if you're not always in control of the situation, they want to feel you've got a leader who knows what they're doing. But there are other ways that you can reconnect, and that's how I do it when I go home. You know, it's why I moved out to the country. I don't live in London anymore. It's because I'm an introvert. I like solitude. I like nature. That's who I always was. And actually now, as I'm heading into, you know, 40 in a few months, it was very important that I become much closer to that person. I'm rambling. I understand that.
You're not rambling at all. I find this really interesting. I also think that enjoying your own company and deciding that you like being by yourself is something I personally have been criticised for enjoying and doing. And I've had it projected. Like, there's me trying to live my best life by having a dream job, you know, living where I want to live, wearing the clothes I want to. And then there will always be someone saying, but you're missing that.
Right.
And so other people projected a black hole onto my life. And it took a real kind of heels in the ground going, actually, my life is fine. And I don't feel like I'm missing something. You think I'm missing something.
Depends how strong your internal voice is, isn't it, I suppose. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about is you obviously had a big friendship circle who were telling you one thing, and I don't know you well enough to, but obviously when you have people telling you should be doing this or you should be behaving that way, it's actually very hard to pull yourself away. I mean, I've said to you, I don't have a big friendship circle. I mean, I really don't have many friends at all. If like I have one or two, and two reasons. One, I'm very, very happy and very content with my own company. I mean, but you know, I get the same thing. I get people going, loneliness is a killer. You know, you need to be really careful. And I was like, I'm aware of that. Mm. But actually, you know, I think it's very hard if you have a lot of voices telling you to be one thing. I don't have those voices. Mm. And also, I think I know myself at 40 pretty well, but it's hard. It's really hard, and you have to either make a break with those people or of course they have got your best interests at heart, and you have to be strong enough to go, totally get it, but I'm happy on you know, just sat in the flower bed on a Sunday afternoon with my dogs, thanks very much.
That makes me very happy. Yeah, exactly.
Does that make you happy? Is that your thing? No
no
that's my thing.
Movies make me happy.
Right.
Movies and reading And I need a lot of recharge downtime.
Right.
And I make no apologies for it anymore. I used to feel really guilty about sitting down on a Sunday afternoon and just being in my own company.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I do find it very hard to sit and read, which is a shame. So that's why the gardening is good, because it's constant struggle. It's constant, you know, the thing about gardening is you can't control it. You can't, certainly can't tame it. It's full of predators. You're constantly having to work. So if you are, and I hate this phrase type A, but if you are quite type A, gardening's really good for you, because A, it kind of takes control of you, but you're constantly doing something. Whereas now, it makes me sad to sit in silence and read. I feel really guilty. And that's a terrible thing. It's really bad, which is why I found, you know, I was like, I've got to have a hobby, because otherwise my life would be work. We don't have kids. So while everyone else is kind of raising human beings, I'm not doing anything in my downtime. And I did go through a period last year, I was like, all I'm doing is working, so I need to find something. And I can't switch off just sat reading, because it feels...
That's very close to what you do for work as well.
It's also very... Because you end up editing it all in your head, or going, I'll never write a sentence like this. So, yeah.
That's the only thing. I have two TBR piles. I've got the piles of books that I'm reading, because publishers have sent them to me and said, do you think this would be a good podcast? And I've got the
TBR. Oh, that would panic me, the big pile.
It does.
Yeah.
And I've got the pile of stuff that I genuinely want to read. And all of that's like transcendental meditation.
And which pile goes down quickest?
It's the work one.
The work one, yeah.
Because there's an obligation to somebody else.
Yeah. And you know, people will say, oh, that's so sad, that's so tragic, Emma. And I would say, well, I found a job that I love doing. Mm-hmm. This is part and parcel of the job. So actually, it's not so sad. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
You know, yeah. So I'm kind of over people that go, well, how tragic for you. You just need time for you. Sometimes the work is pretty important, as long as the work is meaningful for you. I get the impression, obviously, this is you found what makes you tick.
Very much. And you've spoken a lot in the last year or so about the fact that you made the decision not to have children and the effect that that has had. And you said something in one of your interviews that I can relate to so, so much, in that...
You don't have kids, right?
I don't have kids. And it's not that I necessarily may... I've never been in a position where it's come up in a, shall we have children?
Okay, fine.
But I have never had a very strong urge to have children.
Okay.
But I can relate to what you said about you now have friends who are much younger than you or much older than you.
Yeah.
Because they're my friends that I came up with in the magazine industry, for the most part, are now parents.
Yes. Yeah. And that's really hard. And they probably won't raise their... You know, a friend of mine who's a parent, he made me laugh. He goes, it's a mutual friend of mine and my husband's. He said, God, I still think the coolest thing in the world is Shed 7. And he goes, do you know why that is? He goes, it's because when I started my family, they are my priority. I don't have time to kind of come up for air and think about culture and what's going on. So he's like, so I've got this. He goes, I've got like a temporary, this is just him, he's a very funny writer, brain freeze. And he was saying it like it was a bad thing. And I was like, no, but that's absolutely right. You are raising, you know, your little army. And so a lot of people that we used to know now have... now have families of their own. And so I never felt that it was right for me to impose myself in them, because they've got a lot of work ahead of them. And so those friendships, they tether out to sea a little bit, and I think they come back. And so you're left in a situation where, okay, well, who's available? Much younger people. I tend to really like old people. I've just always have liked old people. They're funny, they're obnoxious, they've lived a bit, you know, they've got edges. I like people with edge. So in terms of looking for new friends, it's like, where am I going to go to find new friends? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, I really salute people who can do it all. And, you know, of course, it was my magazine that said you can have it all. It's not true, of course. I always say, if you have it all, you've actually got nothing, because you're not actually doing anything properly. And I decided that I couldn't have the career. I couldn't have the marriage. I think a lot of people think about, well, it's career or kids. If you're married, you know, I know a lot of people whose marriages have suffered because people don't put that into that equation. Mm-hmm. You've got to look after your marriage as well. And so for me, First of all, I struggled to have kids. We did half-heartedly try. I remember the fertility monitor used to get dust on it. And my husband was like, this isn't any good, is it? I said, I know. And then we went down the route of IVF. And I remember I got there and she was telling me, I think we were about to get started. And I just went home and I was like, this isn't for me. You know, I just don't think this is me. And unfortunately, Will was like, this is not for me either. And you know, our careers were really important, but also each other. He was my best friend for many years. That kind of overrode our compulsion to have kids. I mean, I guess I'm lucky. I always say to people, you have to remember, I'm really lucky though, because my desire to have children, it was like a flickering flame. It was not this burning desire that a lot of women talk about, and that's really hard. I think I'm lucky that I've never had that. And, you know, we'll die alone, but you know, we will.
The thing is broodiness is hormones,
right? Exactly,
and I have had so many people say to me, and I do worry, that when I hit perimenopause, all of a sudden that hormone balance is going to go, broody! Right. And I'm going to become that person who goes, oh my God, I wasted the last 15 years. I genuinely now, looking at you in the eyes, don't want to bear a child. But I worry about what hormones do, because hormones are strong mother effers.
Yeah, and that's why you have to have really thought about your decision. Mm. I have thought really long and hard about this. It is not for me. And it could change.
Yeah.
And you know, I did have a wobble like last year. I saw a child on a train and I got really teary. And I suddenly panicked. And I was like, God, I've made this pattern. My husband now, which is he really doesn't want them. And what if I change my mind? And of course I didn't. You know, it was just a kind of wobble. But yeah, it might all change. That's why you have to really stand by your decision. Mm. It's like we said, you can't have it all. You have a moment, you have a window, and you've got to, you know, you're closing it or you're keeping it open. And I think once you've made the decision, it's like in everything in life, you can't have the wobble. You can't be popular and lead a team. You can't have both things, because what ends up is you're not very good at any of it. So with decisions, I think, you know, I mean, the thing is, of course, Emma, is if you did decide you want children, you could, you know, I mean, I would like, I think, probably children in my life. So I'm starting to do quite a bit of charity work with kids at the moment. That's how I kind of compensate, I suppose. So I've completely forgotten my point. But no, yeah, really, you've got to be firm on your decision.
And also it comes back to you can't have it all.
No. And why should you want it all? Do you know what I mean? It's like having it all and doing it all are two very different things. And I honestly do think that when the Cosmo editor in the 60s, but of course she wrote the book Having It All in 82, it was well-meaning, and actually it's what the culture needed at the time, because actually that call to arms for women was, you can have it all, and that got the momentum going for women. So women were like, brilliant, it's all up for grabs. But of course, and I saw this with my mother growing up in the 80s, my mother was a working mother, she had a family of four, she had it all. She didn't have an amazing marriage and she didn't have any time for herself. And I remember looking at that having it all, thinking that's what I'm supposed to want, but it did look an awful lot like doing it all. And they're not the same thing. They're really not. And the irony, as I only found this out recently, is that actually Helen Gurley Brown, who was the Cosmo editor, she really fought to not call it having it all, because actually she didn't have children either. She wanted to call it the Mouse Burger, which was kind of this phrase she had for kind of plucky young women who came from the suburbs and made it in the big city. But it was the publishers who were like, no, you it's going to be called Having It All. And I think it did a lot of damage. I think it was well-meaning to start with, but I think it's not the right message, actually. Especially with what's going on in culture at the moment and anxiety. It's like, why would you tell people, not only can you have it all, you should want to have it all. Maybe you don't want to have it all. I didn't want to have it all because I didn't think I could do it all.
Yeah. And I think what makes it doubly toxic is not only is it you can have it all, you should want to have it all, but also take a look at Instagram. Here's what it looks like. And that's so fake and such nonsense.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I hope with Instagram, I really do hope. And look, I love Instagram. I hope people are starting to realise. I mean, maybe they don't. You know, maybe in our groups, people realise, oh, you know. I mean, even to the, I'm sure you know people, as do I, who they don't even look like that.
Yep.
But I'm really, I suppose the jury is out. I was talking to the girls in the office about this, is actually, if you're like a 13-year-old growing up in Manchester, are you aware of the unreality behind the reality they're presenting? And of course, that they found. I mean, this is not sure that I'm sure I'm misquoting this, but I think Instagram, out of all the social platforms, is the worst for mental health, and you can see why.
I would absolutely imagine it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real problem, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, the kids, which are, I call them kids, the young people, God, I do sound like a nana. Do need to do nana meditation. But you know, suicide now is a real problem. And I was saying to someone, I was like, it's interesting because I know more people now who have committed suicide. Actually, I think there's another phrase now. You're not actually supposed to say that, but than say when I was growing up or say my mum's. And this is based on nothing, but I do wonder about, you know, in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, you know, we were told that high self-esteem, build kids to have high self-esteem, mm-hmm. the X Factor thing, tell them they're brilliant and mm-hmm. they can do anything. And I think it's really dangerous because I think if you go out there and you see it on X Factor when the gran and granddad are there and they put their kid forward and the kid is terrible, mm-hmm. and then the kid comes off because Simon Cowell had said, you're just not talented enough and you're never going to be. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, of course, Simon Cowell is doing them a service in a way. And what I'm trying to get my head around at the moment is, like, if you are told to be brilliant, and our parents have told us you'll be brilliant, you can do whatever you want, and then the world sends you a different message, that's really hard. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether a lot of issues... I mean, I have a real issue with Instagram, and I think women do it in particular, is... I'm sure you have seen this, is someone will put a picture up, and sometimes it won't be a particularly good picture of them, and people will just be like, you're on fire. There'll be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things. Which are supposed to be female empowerment, but I saw this recently, but it was with a lady that I know. It was a terrible picture of her. She's a beautiful woman. It was a really terrible picture, and yet all these people were saying it's you know amazing, beautiful. And I don't know, again, if that's a good thing, because actually, if people tell you one thing and then you go out into the world and the world gives you a different message, that's really dangerous place to be, I think.
Well, it's the anti-social media, and it's that, I forget the formula, but it's something like the reason why all these millennials are so depressed and anxious is because reality is not meeting expectation. Mm-hmm. And it's that thing of, I didn't even know this because I'm not a parent. I don't know what happens at sports days. My memory of sports days is that I was rather rubbish. Right. I was made to do front crawl or breaststroke or something, but I came in last and I could see. No, it was backstroke, and I could see. I was like the last one. I was flailing around trying to finish my second lap, and the games teacher's just slowly walking by the side of the pool, just making eye contact with me, just going,
nodding.
Oh, this is sad.
Shaking the head.
But that was character building in a way, because right. I learned what it was like to not only lose, but to lose really quite monumentally. Yeah.
And to know how it feels to lose. So when you lose, you know... I don't ever want to be there again. Mm-hmm. So I've got to find something I'm really good at.
Yeah.
And were you going to say the participation medals, the medal for 14th
exactly.
and first?
I didn't realise that you've got like gold, silver, bronze, and you've got violet, pink, and right. all of these.
Same with the markings, you know, homework, not to be in violating red pen, to be in, you know, greens and pinks. And of course, as most things are, I don't want to demonise anyone, it is well-meaning. So mm-hmm. so the method behind that was... You know, high self-esteem is a brilliant thing. Well, of course, what we now know, this is a plug, but it's not meant to be, is my husband's book, Selfie, which is about millennials. The self-esteem movement, which was about you got to raise kids with high self-esteem, mm-hmm. it was based on a lie that they cooked. It was supposed to have been based on scientific studies, but Will tracked down one of the guys who was on the self-esteem task force, I think, and he said, we fudged it. So actually, whole cultures, Western cultures, have been created on the myth of building very, very high self-esteem, which could, of course, relate to the high rise in narcissistic tendencies now. And it wasn't even based on anything. So it's not to say what we grew up with was better, but you do wonder, I think, knowing what it feels like to be... to lose is a really important feeling, actually.
And I 100% agree, and I will always use the example of, I remember being at school one day and I was supposed to go into prep because my mum wasn't picking me up till 5.
Right.
And you can't,
I had
just,
one of those.
Yeah. Yes. You can't just have free reign of the school. Yes. So I had to go and do my homework in one of the classrooms, which was obviously supervised back then. And my friend's mum, my friend Serafina, had gone off to go and play netball. And I remember it
so
distinctly.
Serafina.
Serafina.
Wow. You didn't go to my school.
And her mum had come to pick her up. Serafina was off with the netball team, playing netball with another school. And Ben, her little brother, needed to be distracted while she went down to the payphone in the May building to make a call, because this was in the years before mobile phones. Right. So she said, Emma, will you stay with Ben and just entertain him for 5 minutes while I go make this call? Absolutely. I wasn't in prep. I got detention and got lines.
Why?
Because I should have been in prep. I should have said, I can't look after Ben.
I see.
But it was like, you know, friend's mum who I used to spend weekends with. And
yes. Can't do it all, have it all.
You no, you can't do it all, have it all. So I was given lines, and that evening, my mum picked me up, and I said, I've been given lines, I've got to write, I will not go to prep, or whatever it was. And my mum was like, she was just trying to do a nice thing for Patricia. It's not really, come on. And this one was like, no, absolutely not. She's writing those lines. I wrote them through tears. I took them in the next day. I put them on her desk. She didn't even look at them.
No.
She went, put her hand on the top, screwed it up and put it in the bin next to her without even acknowledging me.
And how did that make you feel?
It still makes me angry.
Really?
But I appreciate that I never didn't go to prep again.
Right.
And it made me know my place, which actually, in a school, was important for me to know that there are rules and they need to be followed.
I think, yeah, that's it. And then that, I suppose, you know, and also I suppose it's about there's a hierarchy and you had to respect that, you know, where you were there. And that's why it's interesting, isn't it, at the moment, talking about flat hierarchies, you know, which kind of is doesn't make any sense, flat hierarchy, flat structures even, where you actually don't have any hierarchy. I'm still undecided as to whether I think that's right or whether actually you need leaders. I don't think, it's really interesting with hierarchy, because actually you can be a leader, but you always have to, and you have to constantly prove yourself as a leader. I was saying this to someone in my team. It's like, I would never ask, I always work later hours than my team. Actually, that's not true. Well, I take stuff home because I live very far out, but I probably put in more hours. I still edit most pages in the magazine. I still write for the magazine. Because if you're going to ask someone to do something, they've got to know, A, that you can do it better than them, although a lot of my team are much better writers than me, and that you would be prepared to do it yourself. I think the old school hierarchy of just because I'm the boss, you do what I say, that I'm not sure about. That I think those days are gone. But I do still think people want leaders. I do. I think the structure can be flattened a little bit, i.e., leaders are more approachable and you can talk to them. But I don't know if it should be completely flat, because I, you know, I said to someone, they said, what do you look for in when you're hiring someone? I said, you know what I just want in life? I want somebody to lean across the table. I don't actually want this, but in my dreams, this is what happens. So I'm having a really hard day and someone leans across the table and goes, I was going to say they've put their hand on my hand, but actually they'd be done for harassment. they just say, I'm going to take care of this for you. All you want is to know that somebody knows what they're doing and they know the direction.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
No travel. So again, I've gone wildly off point, but leadership is interesting. And I think good leaders, I think you're right, like your prep school teacher, they have to discipline. I think it's really important. People probably go, that's so old fashioned. You would probably say it was a good thing. Horrible at the time.
I mean, yeah, and I still think, oh, she was such a bitch about it.
I mean, she
it.
Was pretty nasty about it, yeah.
But even so, I do think all of those things are really important, whereas what I understand now is that people like me who had that experience and who wouldn't want it for their kids, if that does happen to their kids, they go into the school and say, don't do that.
Right.
And then that has eroded the ability for teachers to be able to do that. But
yeah.
They are important. It's important to have disciplinarians and role models and all of these things in society. And that is really getting off topic, but it does seem to be that.
Yes, yeah, we are. Sorry.
That is.
Can edit this all out.
No. And also, what was I going to say? It'd be interesting what you're saying about you have to be able to do the jobs that you're asking of your team.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've never, people go, oh, you're quite young to be an editor. And it's like, Not really. All I've done, because actually what I've done is I have done the route that I've come up, which is features. I have been features assistant, then I was junior writer, then features writer, senior writer, deputy commissioning editor, features editor, features director, associate editor. So I have done every single step of a job. I've never had any big, bold leaps. Mm. I've not stayed very long, and that was strategic so I could earn more money.
Yeah.
But it was really, really important. That's why I say to people, don't want to leap so far ahead, because actually when you get to the top, you want to be able to understand everybody's pressures and stresses. So hopefully I can still remember what it's like as a junior when you're agreeing to do everything, but actually you're really struggling underneath. So you should be able to do every single job really well on a magazine before, I think, not just on a magazine, in any corporation. I think those are the best leaders because they truly understand the struggles and stresses and the high points, what motivates people. So it's worked for me.
I wish that the first TED Talk that you did is something that I could have seen 15 years ago.
Oh.
Because I stayed in a job for a really long time, nearly 10 really? Years.
Wow.
Hoping that if I worked a little bit harder, the pay rise would come. If I worked a little bit harder, the promotion would come. And so I just kept throwing. And now when I look at it, my current brain would not compute it in the same way. But
what would your
then,
current brain have said? Get out. Yeah. Because it never comes. If you're waiting and you're asking more than once or twice, it's not going to come. And actually, it's like those boyfriends, isn't it? That, you know, if you want to get them back, you go and date somebody else. That is the reality of it. You've got to keep moving. And if your employer... And, of course, there are reasons why. Because there are some employers who are like... If they're honest with you and go, A, I don't have the money, but as soon as I do, let's work towards that for you. But you've got to do X, Y, Z in order for me to unlock that money for you. Or I've always been honest with people in my career and gone, do you know what? I don't want to lose you. I've done this with actually, wherever I've been a boss, I've done this to a lot of people. And it breaks my heart. But actually, really good, really fair leaders, because I'm not saying I'm a good leader. I'm sure there's lots of people who say I'm not. But really fair leaders should understand that you only get brilliant people for a very short amount of time.
Mm.
You don't get to keep them. And if they're really good, it's a really short amount of time. And there are a couple of people, including two junior people I've got at the moment. I mean, my editorial assistant, actually, she's my PA. She's exceptional. Exceptional young journalist. And so I said to her, probably not allowed to say this, but I said, you know, you need to start thinking soon about your next job. And she's like, but I'm really, really, really happy at Cosmo. And I was like, that's great. I said, but do you know what? If you want to end up editor, I think it's never a good idea to have been the person that's making the teas who then ends up the boss. And of course, in some companies that works.
Yeah.
But there will always be people who will still treat you like the person that made the teas and did the photocopying. But also it's like, you need to start thinking about earning more money. You know, you and I know you don't go into journalism for the money. You do because you love it. Mm-hmm. But you do want to get paid properly.
Yeah.
And so both to her and to many other juniors I've worked with, I'm like, you need to be thinking about your next job because you can come back to work for me, but come in a few years and then your pay is going to increase. If you keep sit there waiting, hoping it's going to come, it's not, you know. You should want me chasing you to get you back.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. And it can be very upsetting for some people because, you know, like Danny, she's only been in the job, at, you know, not so long. But it's hard because if you're in a job you really like, you want to stay there. But the fair thing is to set them free, isn't it? What do they say? Totally. If you set a bird free and it doesn't come back, it was never yours to begin with.
Exactly.
You know, so that's the fair thing to do.
And I have a friend who edits... It was like an overseer. I'm making it sound much grander than it is. But over lots of different titles. And the whenever anyone comes in and he's given them a job, he will say, and I'm going to give you this piece of advice, apply for every job that you think you're qualified for.
Right. Outside of everything here. Oversaw.
Outside of everything here, because that's the only way you're going to know your value. And that's the only way you're going to get the right practice.
Yeah.
And he says, I know that it means I'm going to lose really good people that I want to keep forever. But the last thing you want is somebody really good who gets jaded and bored and feels undervalued because you can't give them more money.
And then they go into their comfort zone, don't they? Except they get toxic with it, actually. Yeah. So, no, he's absolutely right. Of course, you hope... I think the minimum I stayed in a job was 6 months, which is probably not right because I think any less than that, if you leave before that, you have got to rinse also every job out of as much information and as much... I think sometimes, again, I was saying to someone recently, you know, managers... kind of forget that your duty is to pass on the information, you know. That is your job, is to pass on like a grandparent. Here's everything I learnt. Here's everything I failed at. Here's everything I was really good at. And here's, this is what I'm giving to you. And I think some managers don't do that because they're so, and it's really hard because you have to make the time to do it. But I said to some of the younger girls that come into the office, if your manager's not doing that, just ask them. Most of them will be thrilled to. And those that don't, you're probably not working for the right person. Your job is to pass on your skill set to someone else. And I think, you know, people talk about millennials being entitled and saying, can I have some time with you? I think that's the right thing to do. You have to remind your manager their duty of care is to look after you and is to expand, is to help you grow.
It's absolutely true. And also, I was talking to a friend recently who got a new job and was basically in a big board meeting and was like, I'm not learning anything in here. And I just said, well, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Totally.
Advice I would never have taken 10 years ago, but it's just like the learning. It's just, if I'm in a room and I feel like I can't learn anything, I'm in the wrong room and I have to leave it. And
that isn't me. There's that quote, isn't there, that if you're, what is it, something about, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah.
It's totally right. And again, being in a room where you're not the smartest person in the room feels uncomfortable. It feels challenging, but that's right. So that's why you've got to be comfortable with it.
I remember as a young beauty journalist, and bearing in mind that I came from local newspapers and then via work experience got this incredible job on this very, very well-known high-profile magazine.
So you didn't want to go into beauty?
I did.
Oh, you did?
I did, and I'd set my sights on it, so you could say I manifested, and that's something I wanted to ask you about, the discomfort zone. Because it does feel like if you manifest something, if you request it from the universe, it does deliver to you, Farah.
Right.
But I got this job, and it was just overwhelming and incredible. I've completely... Oh, no, on these beauty trips, and I would end up on, like, a first-class cabin of a Eurostar heading to Paris with these people whose pages I'd been reading for years.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I didn't say a word for years because I was just absorbing everything.
And have you told any of those people now? Or
a little bit. Like, but it's funny because a lot of them are my buddies now. Like, I used to...
Really?
Yeah, like Nadine Baggett on Hello Magazine. She used to... And you can't get a word in edgeways with her anyway.
Would she have spoke to you?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
she would have spoken to me.
She just didn't know that you were just too scared to say anything.
Yeah, and I would just... And if I did say something, I'd probably end up oversharing because it was something...
Right.
It was that thing of nerves, of discomfort zone, in which case I'll tell you about that time I got lines from that
panic
teacher.
Piece. Let me tell you about a panic piece.
Yeah, but I know... But again, but because I was the youngest and because I knew the least, if as it were, I would just... If they started talking about products, I would shut up and listen.
And that's hard. That is really hard. I mean, I do understand that because, and that, I don't think that's just an age thing. That's a personality type as well, because I had a girl just come up to me this morning and she stood in front of me and she put a hand out and she went, hi, I'm the new work experience here. And it was like, brilliant.
I love that.
And amazing. Mm. However, which may have been you, certainly has been me, I said to Danny, I said, we need to come up with a much more regimented process for work experience because... That girl is going to be okay in life. She's confident. The fact she can come over to me and barge while I'm in the middle of editing something, brilliant. But there will be someone who will be just as talented who, again, like you, certainly that person was me, who feels they can't or they feel pushy by doing it. I said, so we need to make sure that they get time in with me, but we engineer it in a way. So on those beauty trips, and I'm not blaming the poor lovely PR who put you up, no doubt, in a lovely hotel and took you in the first class carriage. But I, again, this comes down to the leadership thing, doesn't it? It's like if you see somebody who's struggling, you've got to help. You've got to engineer it so that they're part of the conversation.
But I think you and I have a similar problem.
Which is?
We don't look like we're struggling.
No, there is that, yeah.
Because going back to the TED talk about your inner child was the thing of you in a job, you were having a great old time, and then somebody said, we
not
need to have
enough,
a word.
Basically. Yeah, you're chaotic. You're terrible at your job, actually. Well, you're good at one half of your job, and you're dreadful at the other half.
But nobody was, all anybody was seeing was their train tickets not being booked.
Right.
But what they weren't, because... The other thing they were seeing was you walking through the office looking confident. And, and again, that's probably the reason why in two instances you've been asked to launch a magazine and completely well, launch a magazine and then relaunch existing brand. And that once is once, but twice is incredible.
Yeah. Why only like the hard jobs? They have a hard job in this company.
Why do you think people come to you for? Because that's a big deal.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I probably... Well, I guess going on to your first thing, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to know when somebody is struggling. Mm. And that's why you just have to make... I don't like using the word safe space, really don't, because of course it has connotations of what we were talking about before, which is when you're easily offended. And I think you should be exposed to points of view you don't always agree with. Is, you know, that is character building.
Mm.
But I do think you should be running, in my opinion, you should be running a team if you can, because not all corporations allow for this, of course. So it's easy for me to say as a magazine editor who gets quite a lot of autonomy.
Mm.
You have to have an area where people feel they can. And actually, that doesn't mean you sit around and have a meeting, a feelings meeting. I found, a bit like we were saying, that the more open and vulnerable you are to people, they therefore are forthcoming. So people often say to me, God, I tell you the weirdest things, Farah. That's not because I'm a great journalist, or it's not because I ask the right questions. It's often because, and I'm sure you find this, is I tell a lot about my life. Because, I don't fear judgment anymore, but I think if you volunteer information, then other people will. That's the first bit of the question. And then the second bit of the question, I don't know why they asked me to do these jobs. I think, Women's Health, I wasn't asked to do the job. They had an editor there already, and she walked out because I think she thought, to hell with this, it's just not, it's too hard, too much hard work. And interestingly, she's an editor I really like. So I was drafted in. I was like a last minute draft in. So I had moved back from Australia, where Women's Health was a very successful magazine. I didn't work on it. It was on the office. It was in the office kind of down the corridor from where I worked at Marie Claire. It was a massive success. And then I heard on the grapevine through someone that there was this kind of semi-launch of Women's Health. And I was working on a health magazine at the time. It was a really nice job. It was 4 days a week on 5 day a week pay. It was really comfortable, really comfortable. And someone said, there's this job going and you should throw your hat in the ring. And so I did. And then I did think it was weird. They offered me the job almost straight away. And then they said, but we need you to walk out of your current job, that you need to walk out. And I remember as I was about to walk out, somebody from this other company said to me, let me give you a word of advice. You are going to make real enemies if you do this. And she was really threatening, this woman. Anyway, I did it regardless. So actually, I think Women's Health, I got that job not because I'm particularly talented. I think I probably, I wanted it perhaps the most, and I was prepared. The sacrifices, you know, the salary was very bad as well. It was not an editor's salary, but it actually wasn't much more than I was on the kind of 4 day a week thing, but I was prepared to do it. And that sacrifice that you know, I mean, I remember the hours were so long at Women's Health that I remember I think it was on my 33rd birthday, my husband had made me dinner, and I remember I fell asleep while I was in the middle of eating it, and some people would go, oh my God, you're a mug. Like, why would you? But that's the sacrifice. That's what it took. And so I think with Cosmo, though I could be incorrect about this, I think there were two reasons. One, my CEO was a real mentor to me. She's called Anna Jones. She was amazing. And I remember she goes, I think you know what women want, or as good as, because all women are very different, of course. But also I think she'd seen what I could do on Women's Health. And I think she knew Cosmo was going to be really hard. And I think she needed somebody who went in with their eyes wide open. You know, she said to me, and they were a lovely team, the Cosmo team, when I walked in. And it was really upsetting to me that they didn't have the, you know, I don't know, they didn't believe in me, or they'd been there a long time. And I remember saying to them, it's going to be really tough, guys, but the toughness means it's going to change. And for lots of different reasons, a lot of them left. And you know, I still see some of them now, and I wish they had stayed. But I think that's why I got the Cosmo job as well. I think, A, I made a success of Women's Health. Mm. But also, I think the real reason was it was going to be hard. Mm. And you know, I think my boss knew I need somebody who's not only understands magazines. This is more about perhaps a strength of character thing. Somebody who knows that it's going to be tough and that they're not to give up. And there were moments when, you know, I remember my one of the ladies, very senior person who I didn't know at the time, I was in the office at 10 o'clock at night, And she'd heard, I think, on the grapevine that everybody was resigning. And she came in, she works in the event company, and she put a bottle of champagne on my desk, and she went, one day we'll be opening this and it will all be okay. And then she just walked out. It was a very cool thing to do. I mean, I never opened it because I barely drink, but I've actually still got it at home. But it was hard, is my point, I suppose. Mm. It was very hard. And I'm very honest about, you know, in the book, perhaps I don't go into as much detail. It was really hard and soul-destroying. Every time you'd see someone approaching my door, I remember at one point I went, you're resigning. And they go, yeah. So, you know.
How do you not take that personally?
Well, you do take it personally. Well, you do and you don't, because if you are a boss, everything's personal and everything's not personal. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's like when I say to people, when I tell you off, you have to understand, I've forgotten about it soon. It's personal. Actually, it's never personal when I'm telling people off. It's usually because the structure is off on something they've written. But you have to take the personal out of it, because I think if you took everything personally, you'd be a mess. Mm. You'd be an absolute mess. And of course, what people see you like at work and what they see you outside of work are very different. So, yes, it would be very hard not to take it personally. And in the beginning, I did. But that faded after a while, you know. I don't tend to take anything personally anymore. Mm. And that just comes with age. And again, it's probably a gut instinct, isn't it? It's the pattern recognition from going through tough things and, you know, having people resign under me, or, you know, I've not always been popular in jobs I've done. You don't take it personally, you know.
Mm.
This is life, and if you do take it personally, you're probably not made of the right composition, I think, to be a boss. And I decided that very early on, is that if I wanted to be the boss, I don't get to also be, goes back to having it all, I don't also get to go and have drinks with you and talk about my sex life in the pub. And also, God forbid, nobody would ever, my team would not want to know that. I have a real understanding that no matter when people go, oh, come on, Farah, please come for one, they don't want you there. They really don't. As much as the gesture is there, nobody wants their boss in that room drinking with them and you know, getting pissed with them. I don't think that, and I don't think it's good. I think you give them money and you go out and have an amazing time, and I'll see you on Monday morning. But that's the sacrifice. You don't get to be boss and best friend. You have to choose, and you have to be okay with that.
In your TED Talk, you mentioned, and it brings me back to this point, is what we're just talking about you would have maybe described yourself as aloof as a child.
Right.
Or you would have been described as.
Yes.
Even though actually the truth is probably you were very sensitive.
Very introvert. Sensitive and very quiet, yeah.
And yet, that might appear aloof to some people, the fact that you don't go to the pub. Yet.
Yeah.
I know people who work with you and have done under various titles, and the feedback is always unbelievably positive.
Oh,
and I'm not
nice.
Saying this just because you're in the room.
Oh.
And you have obviously got a way of nurturing incredible content out of people. And one of my favourite pieces I've ever read in my entire life is Amy Greer's piece on Can You Die From a Broken Heart?
Oh, yes, yeah. Which actually was her idea.
And I talked to her about it because I then crossed over with her. I was on Women's Health briefly.
Yes, yeah. Yes, you were with us.
Not when you were there. You had
gone.
Was
I not there then?
No, you had gone.
Katie was there?
Yes.
Right.
You had been sequestered away.
but we were in the same room. Were you at Red at one time when I was at Cosmo?
Yes.
I do remember our paths crossing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But this was a while before. And then I became friendly with Amy, who I just think is an incredible writer.
Which is why she's now at Cosmo.
Yes. And I was very, I think I had fangirled her quite hard about that piece. Aww. And I've mentioned it on this podcast before. I think it's just a perfectly constructed feature.
Yeah.
And we became friendly and we would go out and buy coffee. You know, she loves buying her coffee.
Yes.
For her French press. And I said to her one day, you know, that feature was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. And then she began to tell me about the mechanics of putting it together.
Right.
And how it was, she really had to wrestle with it. It was tough. And then she talked about how you helped her construct it, in the sense of you were a part to, she was having all this, not trouble, but she was pulling all these component pieces together and you sort of helped her steer it. And I think that's the sign of a really good editor. So there's a nurturing.
Oh, well, hopefully. I mean, yeah, Amy is one of those, going back to what we talked about. She did Leapfrog. She was a junior writer at Stylist. I said, I'm going to take a risk on you and I'm going to make my features editor. Also because I didn't have a lot of money to pay, so she knows that. But I saw talent in her.
Mm.
I don't think she did want more money from me, but she then got offered a job on a really prestigious magazine, and I was like, take the job. And she came back. Do you know what I mean? So they do come back, and she's now like my associate editor in Cosmo. Yeah, I think that it's like I said, the nurturing is like, if you have these skills, what's the use of these skills without channeling them? And actually, you know, my features team, who I adore all the team. I have to say, I love all of Cosmo. They are such an amazing team. But the features team, I do ask a lot of them. The beauty team as well, actually, I ask a lot of, because I say to them, your best story, and I mean this is the greatest one in the world, is not going to be about perfume. Your greatest story is going to be about you, and it's going to be something that's very, very raw, and it's probably going to be something you don't want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you absolutely go home and think about it over the weekend and come back and go, Farah, I don't want to write about this, fine. But if there is a part of you that feels you want to write about this, because most people, it's like first book syndrome, isn't it? People go, why is the second book never as good as the first book?
Mm.
And I think it was Stephen Fry. Somebody said, well, usually the first books have been in people's heads their entire life. Mm. And then the second book, they've got to turn it around. And usually most people will have one story in them. We've just done one about our beauty assistant who had a nose job. And she wrote the piece and she submitted it. And it was fine. Do you know what? It probably would have gone in. And I went, I need you to rewrite this. And I said, it's not because it's not good, I said, but you have spent a lifetime thinking about this and making sense of this, because she's unhappy with it. I said, go and write another piece. And we talked it through, and I guided them which is the right thing to do, but it's ultimately their piece. So it goes back to being tough and putting them in their discomfort zone, I suppose, that you're never going to get a good piece of writing if you feel comfortable. You're new with your adrenaline, you know, before you start writing. Never going to get the best piece.
Mm.
You need a bit of push, and the push either comes internally or it comes from an editor. But you know what? In my career, I have had instances where, I mean, when I joined Cosmo, I got in trouble early on because there was a writer who I wanted to write a piece, and I thought the writer was up for doing it. And I came in, it was my birthday, I came in on the following Monday, and I was called into a meeting going, there's a feeling you might be pushing people into writing stuff that they don't feel comfortable writing. And I was like, really? And we had this big meeting, and it transpired actually that this person did want to write this feature, and the feature was bloody amazing in the end. But they felt they hadn't been asked to do it before, they hadn't been pushed, and I guess that just comes from different bosses' style. It's like, if you want a comfortable life and if you want to write stuff which, you know, I'm not saying you produce terrible work if you're comfortable, because that's the wrong thing, but you probably wouldn't come and work for me. I think probably, and I don't know if this is your experience, the people you know who have worked under me, but I do push people quite hard. And so I think at times in my life, I maybe have pushed some people too hard. Not many, actually. But you have to know. You have to know when to go, do you know what? And I'm on a learning process too. I know, you know, some people love it and some people don't like it. And probably the people who don't like it so much don't stay very long. But the people who like it goes back to, we need, you know, human beings are designed to carry a load, struggle sometimes. I mean, you know, in the book, Marcia Kilgore, who I'm sure you know, launched Bliss, she talks about there's a slog and there's a grind, and then there's success. And success is this tiny thing at the top, and you don't get it for very long.
Mm.
Then you're back on the grind again. And she was like, slog is when you're just working and working and nothing changes. But grind is that real challenge state where you're really working very hard, but you can feel things moving and changing. And that's what I try and say to the writers. The grind state is where the really, really good stuff happens.
Mm.
And the success is when you win the award, which a lot of them, I'm delighted to say, have won now. And they've all come from pieces they found very difficult to write about. Mm. It's a very long answer, so no, I'm not sure what the question was.
I think it's really interesting because obviously when one writes, I mean, I've had this, I would love to be able to write a feature, submit it to you, and for you to say, Emma, this is perfect, no changes. But
that has happened only once to something going in the next issue.
Okay.
But she spent a life, it's been in her head for a lifetime. That's why it's perfect.
Well, that's actually what Eve said previously on the podcast when she was talking about her first album had been her entire life.
Right.
And then her second album, she had to turn around in 10 weeks.
So there you go. And so the perfection comes because actually we're naturally, the brain is a natural storyteller, isn't it? We're telling ourselves in our heads, you know, we're the heroes of our own story. But because it's a natural storyteller, if that's been her entire life, as has the piece that this lady has just submitted to me, which was perfect, technically a perfect piece of writing, you make sense. Do you know what I mean? So the perfection is just taking a very, very long time to do. So, you know, I may email you back and go, "Emma, this is perfect," but I guarantee it would be on something that you've been thinking about writing about for years of your life. I've never had that from anyone going, "It's perfect."
But it's also the fact that I was talking to a young journalist, which sounds patronising, but she's 24.
Right.
And she was...
She's young to you and I.
Yeah, she's young to me. Yes. She was really crushed because she had submitted something and it came back with lots of changes. And she took it as, "I can't write," because she really respected the commissioning editor. And I just said to her, "I could write something that would, in my mind, me as an editor, would think, well, Emma, you've done a perfect job here."
Right.
And I could send it out to three of my buddies with varying experience in the media and they would all have input. So don't take it as you can't write. No. Take it as they are helping you shape that bit of clay.
That's it. I guess that's when it comes back to what you're saying about the nurturing. It's how do you give it back? Do you give it back as a red rag and go, redo it? Or do you give it back and go, "I'm going to talk you through exactly why this..." Sometimes in my team, it's like, "Your sentence is good, but if you did this, can you see the difference between the two?" So, and of course, you have to be careful. It doesn't sound like you've been patronising, of course. But I guess it's the way in which you tell people. Of course, it's very difficult if your friend was freelance and you've got a commissioning editor who is probably bashing out, is editing hundreds of things. Mm. You don't have time. And that's when I feel for freelancers. That's why I actually think young journalists should work on a magazine and then you go freelance later on, because that is demoralising when they just go, "Can you just do a second draft? It's not right. It's really hard."
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, at Cosmo, we would go through it line by line. That is hard. It is crushing.
Is that what you do? You would sit with the writer?
Yeah, and I go through it. And I go through line by line. And sometimes, you know, you feel a bit of a beast because, you know... But this is the good thing, I think, about my team, is that even the really senior people I will go through... And of course, I will say to them, "I put this in. This isn't right. Do what you think is right." And some people can say, "Well, it's heavy editing what you do, Farah." But they can always change it. But I do go through it line by line. I think after a while you have to stop. If you're doing that all the time with someone, then it's slog, isn't it? It's not grinds. Yeah. It's not moving.
I wish I'd had that experience on magazines. I never did. It was baptism of fire. It was.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. Do you know what? I didn't have it. And so I think, why do I do it? Do you know what? On a very, very deep level, it's probably because I don't have any kids. You know, it's probably, what do I do with all this stuff? Well, you give it back to people. And yeah, I that's probably why. And also, do you know what? I did have an amazing editorial director on Women's Health, he was over Men's Health, but he was amazing to me, actually. He went through everything almost line by line and was like, "This is how you do a cover. This is how many letters you need. This is the colour that works."
Oh, wow.
To that level. And I remember he had a manual. It was like a magic manual, which I still have in my locker. It was a magic manual of how you make a magazine. And he was like, "Here, this is like from me to you." It was an amazing act of generosity. And he was not an easy man, but he pushed me like, you know, but I think something in me responded to him pushing. But yeah, so actually I did get that probably. I didn't get it with my writing, but I certainly got it in how to edit a magazine. And that was, again, he'd learnt the hard way. But he had, with Men's Health, had created a phenomenally successful product. And he was like, "Do this and it will be a success."
Have you ever been pushed or have you ever been guided by somebody senior? And have you ever had to say, "This isn't the right way. I'm not going to respond to this. Back down."
No, I don't think I have. I've had nightmare jobs, and again, I think they're really important to have bad jobs in your... You probably don't want too many. If you start having loads of bad jobs, I would say look at the pattern. Is there something in you? But I think to have one or two bad jobs is really important, because then you know the difference between what is a job where you're feeling challenged but it's hard and what's just a nightmare job that changes the colour of everything. And I've had one of those. And for a long time, I thought the boss was wrong. with hindsight, I think I wasn't good enough to do the job I was doing. It was when I was in Australia, so I made all my mistakes out there, so no one knows about them. I don't think I was good enough for the job. And you know what? The editor was a bit... She was... I'm very fond of that editor, actually, but she was quite loud and quite brash, and was famously so. And at the time, I was very angry against her. But now I think I was not good enough for that job, and she was probably right. So no, I've never had that, to be honest. And actually, I think if I didn't agree with the manager, it goes back to it depends. If it's a manager who I think they're better than me at my job, they would do exactly what they're asking of me, then I would try and see their point of view. There must be method in the madness. I think it's those managers where they expect... respect by hierarchy without showing anything for it, that's difficult to take instructions from. But I've never had that. I've been really lucky. My bosses have all been people that I go, you should absolutely be my boss. You are much better than I am.
It's difficult. It's that pedestal thing. It's putting them on a pedestal for a right reason and not just because they have
the
superior job title.
Yes, that's it. But they've got to work for that. Do you know what I mean? It's like I have to work for my... team's approval as much as they have to work for the approval of me. It's both of us have to do it in very, very different ways. And I think you can forget that as a boss. Yeah. You don't just get to be boss because you're earning more money and you got the title. You've got to show that you've got your place there.
Do you think there is a pivotal discomfort zone moment that has defined your ability to use it as a positive in your adult life?
I think, I think it wasn't one moment, it was more a series of moments. It was probably the first, those 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks, I forget now, it's all a blur, of building Women's Health from scratch, so creating a brand with nothing, and realising that everything we thought made us weak, no money, no time, no staff, was the thing that made us strong. So the lack of constraint. Yeah. And actually in the book, I remember I was starting to think about constraint and how it's a really interesting constraint, because why would anybody want to impose constraints? Whereas now, of course, I like to impose constraints, time limits, teams. I always take a person out of a team if they're working on a project. When I looked into it was things like the impressionists, of course. They confine themselves to using certain brushstrokes and certain colours. Steven Spielberg, I think this is in the book, but if it's not, it's very interesting.
Yeah,
with Jaws, he thought he was going to use a massive mechanical shark, and the shark broke down. He couldn't use it, and so he was forced to rely on, well, of course, in Jaws.
Yes,
that's it, on two notes, and pretty much never seeing the shark. And of course in Jaws, when you do see the shark at the end, kind of looks silly, that mechanical, it looks really disappointing, because nothing is as scary as the water and John Williams's music. And it is born of constraint. So Women's Health without doubt was the pivotal, those pivotal 6 weeks, I think were changed everything. It's when it made me realize discomfort can absolutely be a force for good if you understand it. You know, I'm not telling people to go out and just be in panic mode the whole time.
But I think when we are, by the very nature of everyday life, forced into a fight or flight physical reaction, just by walking down the street with advertising, or by the smell coming out of shops, or I shouldn't say smell, but, you know, the aromas coming out of various shops to try and lure you in, it's sensory overload, and it does force your...
Why can't you say smell?
Because I'm a beauty journalist.
Oh, I see. Okay, the aromas. Okay, yeah. Yeah, but
because I'm thinking of Abercrombie and Fitch, and it makes me gag. But I hate.
Does that have an aroma? Is it of like oiled men or something?
They pump out that scent, and it genuinely makes me gag.
Oh, okay. I just think about. I mean, they probably can't do it anymore, right? Do they still have the half naked men? I always felt sorry for them.
I don't know.
Surely they can't. Because we got rid of the naked centerfold because it was like, if you don't want to be objectified as a woman, we can't do this. And I often used to think about Abercrombie. It's like those poor men. And they were always like someone's young teenage son.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's just like Hooters, really. It's kind of the same. Mm. And you know, I was guilty. I would used to go, my office at Glamour's around the corner, you'd go and you'd giggle and you'd laugh at them. It's like, how awful.
I know.
I mean, they probably didn't think it was awful, but they may have done, you know.
No, I felt really bad the other evening because I was objectifying Chris Hemsworth, Chris Pratt, Chris Evans and Chris Pine on social media.
Unless they want to be objectified. I don't think they do.
No.
No, I don't think they do.
No, I was just suggesting, you know, if you were to spend... I want to start a magazine called The Crishu, which is just a magazine about all four. Some editors have already turned it down. But I was just joking. It was very lighthearted. It was like, if you could spend a day with the Chrises, how would you spend it? And right. It wasn't, nothing sexual was implied, but obviously right. It's like.
But it was.
Maybe. Yes, your interpretation. And afterwards I thought, if a man put that about women, I would be pretty disgusted. And so I was like.
It's really hard, isn't it? Because. At the same time, you also don't want to live in a world where it's like where people go, well, you can't flirt anymore. And it's like, well, what a shame that you can't flirt, because that is one of our deepest impulses is, I fancy you, I would like to flirt with you. Mm-hmm. So I've been to Christmas parties recently where they are just so boring. It's just like men in a corner, scared of what to do.
Looking for mistletoe and running from
right,
it.
Right, exactly, yeah. I mean, you won't be able to have mistletoe soon.
No.
So it's really interesting. Yes, you absolutely should. If you don't want to be objectified, then you shouldn't do it. But then there is also the argument, and this is why there is no blanket rule for everything. Mm. It's like, a lot of women I know don't like to be objectified. Some women, they like to be objectified. You know what? If a man appreciates her wearing a dress, that's okay. Mm. It's how you interpret it, really. But yeah, if the Hemsworth was to walk down the street and you start wolf whistling, I'd probably say it's not appropriate, Emma. Unless of course he was like, yeah, I'm totally. Do you know what I mean?
I know
so
exactly.
So
yeah.
Everything is so individual, and that's why, you know. Sometimes I think it's great what's happening at the moment where we have lots of big groups and mass movements. And, you know, the women's movement is wonderful. It's brilliant. You know, it's probably one of the most significant changes to have happened. But within that spectrum of women, everyone is different.
Mm.
So, and actually the piece that I was telling you about, which is, when is this coming out?
When the book comes out.
All right, so I can tell you about this piece because it's on sale now. So the piece that I said came in, which is Perfection, is a really, really interesting piece. And I suspect if I don't have complaints waiting in my inbox now, I will get complaints about it. But the piece is about a young woman who was raped. And to cut long story short, she was raped in America. And she attended a university where a lot of the Me Too kind of, not its origins exactly, but it was a university which was very famous for, it was very vocal on men and consent. And there was a very famous, I don't know if you remember this, there was a very famous rape which was alleged to have happened on this campus. It was Columbia. And the young lady in question, she took it to the university, and the university said, there's not enough evidence. I think that's what happened. And so what this young woman did is she walked around for the rest of the year with a mattress attached to her, and she had something written. She had something written on the mattress, but it was a statement basically. And across Columbia University, there were these big kind of signs everywhere going, "Rapists live here." And it became in America. A real seminal moment. And so anyway, so the writer who has written this piece for us was at Columbia at the time, and she was raped. She wasn't raped on campus, she was raped off campus. And it was really interesting because after the rape, she didn't tell anyone at first, and she said she dealt with it, and it was horrible. Of course it was horrible. But she said, interestingly, she was bullied very, very, very badly when she was younger. And she said nothing will ever compare to how bad that was. I think she had like her arm broken. I mean, it was severe. So she said, so I dealt with the rape and it was awful and I wish it never happened, but I dealt with it. But when she told people later on about it, she said, actually, the women's group at the university said, you need to be a spokesperson for this now. Like, you have a duty to talk about this. Mm. And she said, I don't want to. This is my choice. And it's interesting in the piece, and of course it's a very nuanced piece, and I'm probably being very gauche saying this, but what the piece explores is when you don't agree, if somebody believes they are the force for good, which of course on this campus these women believed they were the force for good, and largely they probably were, but when it came to this writer, they weren't, because she felt pressured into something she didn't want. And she said when they turned on her, she said in many ways it was as difficult as the rape, and actually her difficulties came from the movement on campus. And so I wow. suppose my point is, which I'm very being very inarticulate about, is that the thing about groups is they are brilliant in some ways because they they gather momentum. Mm-hmm. But what you can't forget, and you see this in, you remember when you used to be at school and the teacher used to divide you into two groups. You go, your team B, your team A, mm-hmm. and you were competing. The minute your friend went into team B, they stopped to be your friend. They were part of team B. And a group, it's like at football matches, they're just a silhouette and you don't see the people within it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a worry. Mm. That, you know, and so this piece explores that. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of writing.
That's out, but I will also put the link to it if it's going to be online.
It will be online. Okay, yeah,
that will be in the show notes. I'm very mindful that we're coming to the end of our time together, so I want to thank you. We've been rabbiting on for an hour and 25 minutes.
Oh,
can
wow.
you believe? And I'm aware that you have a magazine to edit.
That's quite all right.
Overall, the discomfort zone, as I said to you, I found it incredibly easy to read. I felt like I literally felt like it held my hand through experiences that I've had, validated a lot of my anxieties in terms of those live TV moments where I've just been able to perform.
Right.
And it made me understand all of those impulses that potentially you can't control, it really made me understand them well. So I think that's highly valuable.
It's supposed to be very, very practical. Mm. But, you know, if that came in, if I was the editor of that, my editor is amazing, it's far from perfect. You know, it's not perfect piece of writing. I'm happy with the book, but that's right. Nothing is ever finished. It's like, I think it's Pixar. They send the films out. It's never finished. It could always be good enough.
Well, there's so many people.
It could always be better, sorry.
Yeah, there's so many people I've had on who've written books who say, if I'd had another month,
it would have been perfect. Yeah, it's never finished.
And never. I think that's fine. I actually... And the tagline for it, I don't know if tagline's the right word, that's very movie-oriented.
Is it like a sub-cell or something?
Sub-cell.
It's a sub-cell.
That's very magazine.
Yes. Yes, it's a sub-cell.
How to Get What You Want by Living Fearlessly. And I watched a talk, it was a TED talk with my good friend Tim
you
Ferriss.
You like TED talks.
When I was depressed and I didn't have people that I felt comfortable going to because I felt like I've been too vulnerable and I was sick and tired of seeing pity in people's eyes or them rolling their eyes thinking, oh God, is she really going on about this again? I looked to the internet and TED Talks, and Tim Ferriss does a brilliant talk about fear setting.
Yes, I've seen it.
Which reminded me of this. So you should do a joint TED Talk and then introduce me to Tim.
Are you a fan?
Are
you objectifying him?
No, I'm not objectifying him.
I'm joking.
Him.
He is very handsome.
He is. No, he... it was his podcast because he interviewed Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a hero of mine, and I listened.
God, you are a kid of the 80s.
Yeah. He used to be a skinny Austrian kid, and everything he set his mind to, he achieved.
Yeah, yeah.
I admire that. That's why I have a heart-shaped locket with his name on it.
Really?
Yeah. He's a...
Should maybe... kept his hands off his nanny.
Yeah.
Was it the housekeeper? Was it the housekeeper?
Absolutely. Yeah. That is not stuff that I approve of. but the fact that he said, right, I'm a skinny boy, I want to become the biggest man, biggest, strongest man, and he did it. I want to marry... He married into the freaking Kennedys.
Yes, yeah.
And then he became the governor of California. Then he said, I'm not only going to become the biggest movie star in the world, but every time I do a movie, the next movie I'm going to earn double. So he earned $500,000. Then 1 million, then 2 million, then 4 million. He literally...
So he manifested.
He manifested, and he just... I mean, I do think some of his tactics... He used to AMOG people, so if he'd be in the gym and people would say, I'd never want to be as big as you, and he would look at them and say, that's fine, you never will be. Like, he knew how to cut people down, but with a smile. And I think one of his sayings is, kill people with your success and then bury them with a smile. Or something like that. It's basically...
You know what? I think because of the voice, you think he's not bright. And everyone I know someone that used to work for him said he's...
Pardon?
So, yes, I have a contact. The contact also said they did see him with the... You might have to edit this out. They did see him with
maybe
the,
don't say
the
it,
housekeeper yeah. once. Just touched his bow tie, just straightened it. And he just thought, yeah... No, I'm not sure about that. But he said he was a genius. He's so, so clever. Yeah.
He's a dream podcast guest, but Tim's had him on the show. And so when I was feeling very, very blue, and I was looking blue, I'm really like sugarcoating it. But I would look for things like that. And I remember listening to that podcast, and then I listened to his podcast with Triple H. I listened to his podcast with loads of people. And because of that, it was as if where my own brain was sort of kicking me when I was down, there were things going in that were actually building me up again.
Right.
And so I will always be very grateful to Tim Ferriss for that.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger.
and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Well, I'm sure we'll have conversations with both of them one day. I'm very excited about this book. I'm very pleased that A, you wrote it, and B, I got to ingest it in one sitting. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Listeners, the links to buy The Discomfort Zone and to Farah, all of her social channels, Farah and Cosmopolitan, the features that we've talked about, everything will be in the show notes on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and wherever it is that you might be streaming or downloading this particular episode. But for now, thank you so much.
Welcome. Thanks, Emma.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode of the show with Farah. If you want to get in touch with me, please, 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 it's so easy. One of my favourite things is getting emails from listeners. So just drop me a message to thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. Or if you feel more comfortable, why not just send me a DM on Twitter or Instagram, where I'm at Emma Guns. It's a joy, joy, joy to hear from you. If you are enjoying the episode and you never want to miss one, just go over to wherever you're listening, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Acast, or any other streaming service, and click that subscribe button. That way you'll get a notification every time a new episode drops. And if you do love the show, and I really sincerely hope that you do, I would be so grateful if you could leave a 5-star review and perhaps a couple of sentences about what you enjoyed about a particular episode or the podcast in general. Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure to spend this time with you, and I will see you on the next one.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.